Is the U.S. headed for a fiscal cliff?
That's the term being thrown around this week in Washington.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. It's Thursday, May 17th.
Coming up, Chesapeake Energy drills itself into a big financial hole.
Who do Americans trust to fix the economy?
And the Staples Center here in Los Angeles prepares for its craziest weekend ever.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Well, we've talked all about the debt problems in Europe, but right now we're going to talk about some debt warnings right here in the United States. Adolfo Laurenti is Deputy Chief Economist with Mesirow Financial. He's with us now from Chicago. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Adolfo, we're hearing, from the Federal Reserve and from lawmakers in Washington that there's a fiscal cliff coming at the end of the year. What does that mean?
Well, beginning next year, we are going to face a twofold challenge. First of all, the Bush tax cuts are set to expire, which may result in higher taxes for all the taxpayers. And second, we'll hit again the debt ceiling. Now, following the debacle of 2011, Congress has set into law some automatic and fairly draconian reduction in federal spending that will follow. So at the same time, so we may face both a tax squeeze and deep spending cuts, and that in a nutshell is the fiscal cliff we may face in early 2013.
So if that happens then, and we do face those two things, what does that mean for the economy?
Well, depending on the combination of the two, we may face some fairly headwinds on economic growth and GDP. Some estimates point to a 1 to 2% reduction in activity, and this economy is already fairly fragile. We are just growing a little bit above 2%, so that might be a major hit.
And I assume, Adolfo, that all this is moot if one party really gets a decisive win in the election?
Yes, you know, in theory, one party may sweep both Congress and the White House and fix these issues, but in practice, we look at polls, and that doesn't seem to be a likely scenario. You know, depending how the combination of White House and Congress, House and Senate will play out, we may have a different combination. But, you know, gridlock and a standoff between Republican and Democrats really makes the possibility of a fiscal cliff to become very, very real.
Adolfo Laurenti is Deputy Chief Economist with Mesirow Financial. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel sent a message to players in financial markets. She's committed to keeping Greece in the eurozone. In an interview with CNBC, Merkel said that she is open to economic stimulus at a time that Greeks are blaming austerity imposed by Europe for their woes. More on that in a moment.
But first, to Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London, who reports the European Central Bank is cutting off funding for some Greek banks.
Could this be the beginning of the end for Greece's euro membership? If the European Central Bank stopped providing funds to the country's whole banking system, Greece would crash out of the eurozone. It would run out of cash and it would have to start printing its own currency just to stop the economy collapsing. Now, we are not there yet. The European Central Bank has not cut off funding for all Greek banks, just to four of them. But the fact it's taken this step at this sensitive time could be significant. Peter Thal Larsson of Breaking Views says it could be a warning shot to Greek voters ahead of next month's election.
If you choose a party that is not prepared to abide by the terms of the bailout, then we will cut you off and you will have to leave the euro.
Some analysts say the central bank's action is only technical and temporary. But shouldn't the bank be cutting Greece some slack instead of cutting its funding? In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Now to those comments from German Chancellor Angela Merkel that she's sending the message that she's committed to keeping Greece in the eurozone. The BBC's Steve Evans joins us from Berlin. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
Steve, a change of heart for arguably the most powerful politician in Europe, do you suppose?
A change of heart, a change of policy? I don't think so.
No.
At the end of it all, she believes that you spend what you get in revenue. Having said all that, she can see the situation in Greece. And she's got a new president in France who was elected by voters who want growth. What I think will happen will be a bit more spending in Germany, but all the indications are that the Eurozone crisis is getting worse and people are talking much more loudly about the exit of Greece, and that would be very messy indeed.
So cautious talk about not quite as much austerity, you don't think would be enough to keep Greece in the Eurozone alone?
No. They've got a recession and some. The situation is getting worse, and any kind of reflation of the German economy or new spending projects in Brussels are not going to transform that situation. They would take far too long, even if they were big enough, and you can't have them big enough without breaking that strict austerity rule that Chancellor Merkel believes in so strongly. All the sense in Europe now is of a situation which is moving very, very fast away from policymakers.
The BBC's Steve Evans in Berlin. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Remember that $2 billion loss at J.P. Morgan that came from risky bets? Well, according to the New York Times, you can go ahead and make it a $3 billion loss. Marketplace's Gregory Warner reports.
Jamie Dimon did warn us on Sunday on Meet the Press.
We took a $2 billion loss, and we made it clear it could get worse before it gets better. You know, it could be volatile by $1 billion, possibly.
And volatile it is. Those losses from J.P. Morgan's bad bets are now estimated at $3 billion. Ruth Bender is a corporate governance expert at the Cranfield School of Management in the U.K. She says the irony is that the bank's position gets worse the more it tries to extricate itself.
So everybody knows J.P. Morgan has got to untangle itself. And so everybody else on Wall Street is saying, well, if they're going to do this, we're going to do that. So every day the market trades, the situation can get a little bit worse for them.
Even if the losses increase, Bender thinks this won't affect the bank or its stockholders financially. She expects a healthy dividend at the end of this quarter.
I think it's more an aspect of confidence than any lasting damage. It shows that things can go very wrong in a very large institution.
And that could strengthen the political push for a rule that would make it harder for big banks to make similar bets. I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
The big NATO summit starts in Chicago today, so to protest there, with demonstrators streaming in from across the country. Some in Occupy Wall Street see the planned marches as a crucial chance to energize their movement. But as our Wealth and Poverty Desk's Chrissy Clark reports, Occupy 2.0 might have less to do with big marches and more to do with
moments like this, when 75-year-old Beverly Roberts came to a city council meeting this week in Los Angeles. She described her 4-year fight with a bank to get a loan modification.
You know what? I'm tired. Just make them responsible and do the right thing.
Roberts was there to support a new policy called the Responsible Banking Ordinance. It will force banks doing business with LA to provide detailed information on things like how many foreclosures they do and how many loans they give, neighborhood by neighborhood. The idea is that if banks have to make that stuff public, the public can hold them accountable. City Councilman Richard Alarcón came up with the idea a few years ago, but it didn't get traction until Occupy came along.
There's no question that the Occupy movement defibrillated the ordinance.
And not just in L.A. New York City passed a similar policy this week with the help of Occupy organizers. Boston, Philadelphia, and San Diego might also push through bank transparency requirements. Without any real teeth, it's unclear whether these kinds of ordinances will make any difference in how banks do business. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
The nation's second largest natural gas company, Chesapeake Energy, has seen its stock plummet almost 40% this year. And this week, it's been borrowing billions of dollars at high interest rates just to make ends meet. Marketplace's Scott Tong joins us now from Chesapeake's home base in Oklahoma City with an explanation. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, Scott, remind us why Chesapeake Energy is in so much trouble right now.
Well, it's an inherently risky company. But with Chesapeake, the company borrowed too much money to finance its operations. It spent too much money to lease the land to drill on. And it was overweight in natural gas. It has drilled so much of that instead of other commodities like crude oil. And now prices have plummeted and they're really in trouble.
And what does this mean for the industry outside of Chesapeake Energy, if anything?
Well, it's affected the whole industry. So if you sell any product and the price plunges, everyone hurts. So all the companies are really feeling it now. But with Chesapeake, because they were so leveraged, and now there are revelations of potential conflict of interest, that they have to sell off prime real estate because of this cash flow problem, now all bets are off what may happen next with the company. The folks here say they wouldn't be surprised if the CEO had to step down, and he's a legend in Oklahoma City, or the company declared bankruptcy, or if it got acquired by another company.
And are the employees there worried about this? I know you've been talking to some of them.
Most that I talked to did not, and that's the interesting thing. I went to the company campus, and it is a very, very nice place. It looks like a university campus. I mean, they're playing ultimate frisbee at lunch. And many said, you know what? I'm not too worried. There are a couple whispers that there may be a lot of layoffs coming, but by and large, they think they can ride this out.
Marketplace's Scott Tong in Oklahoma City. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
The White House says President Obama will not allow more brinksmanship over America's debt ceiling. It's pursuing a, quote, balanced approach, meaning spending cuts and higher taxes, particularly on the wealthy, something the White House says most Americans support. Like the Republican nominee Mitt Romney says Americans do not want higher taxes. But who has the most credibility on these matters? Let's look at that as part of our weekly partnership with Gallup.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
For Attitude Check, joining us now is Frank Newport, Gallup's editor-in-chief. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning, David.
So, my fellow Americans, who will do a better job on the economy, Mr. Obama or Mr. Romney? What'd you find?
Well, that's a fascinating question, and Romney has the edge, and this is important. 55% say if Romney's elected, the economy will be better in 4 years, and only 46% said the economy would be better in 4 years if Obama's elected.
People, Frank, give reasons for why they were giving this edge to Romney?
We didn't follow up with an open-ended question and say why, but we had some other data where we said who would do the better job on various dimensions. And Obama wins on likability by over 20 points. But we also said who would be the better manager of government, and that's one where Romney edges Obama as well. So I think part of it may be this image of Romney, although not likable necessarily compared to Obama. He's kind of the cold, calculating, efficient CEO-type manager, and that's what Americans, it looks like, may think is needed to handle the economy.
What about the road ahead when you ask these questions about matters of money to Americans? What are people thinking prospects are for their finances?
Well, you know, David, Americans are always more positive about themselves than about the situation out there. You know, they like their congressman, they don't like Congress, they think they have good health care, but health care is in a crisis. And the same thing happens on the economy. We have 63% of Americans in our just completed poll who said they will be better off financially next year, and only 18% say worse off. Now, that sounds rosy, but Americans are usually positive, but that 18% worse off is as low as we have seen it going back to about 2003. So the degree that Americans continue to think things are looking better, that certainly helps Obama's reelection chances.
Always fascinating. Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of Gallup. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
News Corporation announced this week it's joining forces with a Chinese movie distributor to gain more access to China's growing market for films. Earlier this year, DreamWorks announced it had formed a joint venture with a Chinese movie studio as well. Now, these joint ventures aren't just limited to China, nor to the movie industry. Marketplace's economics correspondent Chris Farrell joins us now to explain. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So is this something that companies are doing more now? They're getting together with other companies and forming these joint ventures?
Well, I got curious about this when I saw GM took a 7% stake in Citroën, the European car company owned by Peugeot. And I was going, you know, I've seen this a lot. You know, it is growing, and it's growing for two major reasons. One reason is the bad economy. Credit is tight. All of us are trying to do more with less, just like workers are trying to do more with less. So are companies. And a joint venture is one way to do that.
So it's about saving money.
That's one aspect of it. The other aspect is we live in a global economy. We use that term a lot. But in this global economy, U.S. companies are moving into China, right? You set up a beachhead there. Chinese companies coming here into the U.S. You want a local partner. You know, you want a friend in the neighborhood. You want someone who kind of knows how the system works.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of American Airlines got into a big partnership with Japan Airlines, which gives them access all over Asia.
Well, when you walk into an airport, it's like partner, 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 partner.
Yeah, code share.
Yeah, lots of joint ventures.
Well, do these joint ventures end up working out? Do they last or are they just for the tough economic times?
Well, joint ventures have kind of a bad aura. And here's the thing. If you're a manager, you own a company, you're running a company, you want to acquire a company or you want to grow your own company. So the joint venture is a little bit of a compromise. However, I think there's growing realization that in this global economy, this is the way to go. And there's a lot more resources devoted to how do you manage them. But in general, after about 4, 5, 6 years, a lot of times they fizzle.
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell, thanks as always.
Thank you.
It is once again the time of year when TV executives are planning their fall lineups by figuring out who is going to pay for all those ads. But the best laid advertising plans could be thwarted by a new service from Dish Network, the satellite TV operator, that lets users skip commercials altogether.
Here to talk with us today on this Marketplace Midday Extra is Joe Flint of the Los Angeles Times. Hello there, Joe.
Hello.
Help me understand this. I remember like when TiVo first came out, you could easily zip out the commercials and the advertising industry practically had an infarction.
Well, yes. The idea of being able to fast forward through ads, of course, isn't new. Anyone who has a DVR sits there and probably hits the fast forward on a recorded show after the commercial break starts. The difference with Dish's auto hop is you don't even see those images. The screen goes black when a program enters into a commercial break, and then it comes back a few seconds later, commercial's gone. And yeah, that's obviously not sitting too well with the broadcast networks and the advertisers who spend a lot of money to try to get their message out to consumers.
But these things never seem to last, right? I mean, when TiVo comes out with theirs or whoever, or, you know, my DVR doesn't even allow me to skip the commercials.
There was a service once called Replay that tried to do something that Dish is doing, and it was shut down. The network sued on copyright infringement and were able to prove their case. Obviously, people can skip ads, but that's going to get tougher and tougher because both the content providers and the distributors need commercial revenue. And it is a challenge, though, because, of course, most viewers have a grudging relationship with commercials.
Now, I get the fact that Dish Network is subscription-based. It gets its money by signing you up month to month, but don't those folks realize that a lot of the content on the Dish Network is, in fact, made possible by ads?
We all know that commercials help pay the bills, but that doesn't mean we enjoy watching them. You know, from my personal standpoint, sometimes I fast forward through commercials. Other times it literally slips my mind and I don't. But there are people who just vehemently oppose commercials, even though they may understand that that's what pays the bills. And without the commercials, the show they're watching, whether it's Mad Men on AMC or CSI on CBS, wouldn't exist. You know, everyone wants to find the shortcut, though, to get away from someone trying to sell something to them.
Is the concern from the networks really about Dish Network, or is it just that this technology is going to exist and therefore others might copy Dish Network and do the same thing?
Clearly, it's both. And the networks may have a way around this anyway. You know, they can not sell their programs to Dish. They can say, if you're not going to present it in the way we want you to present it, then we won't sell it to you. But Dish makes a technology, and if they have a patent on it, presumably, they can then try to sell it to other distributors and see how far that goes. Now, a lot of distributors also own programming. So Comcast is the nation's biggest cable operator, but they also own NBC.
Right.
They're not going to be pushing a device that helps people eliminate commercials.
So then there's this other wrinkle, which is that apparently Dish Network wants to run a commercial for this. And some of the broadcasters like Fox and NBC are like, I don't think so.
There's a little bit of irony here, I guess. They have a product they want to get out that eliminates commercials, and they need commercials to get the word out on that product. Certainly can't blame Fox and NBC, and I imagine the other networks will follow suit in saying we're not going to run an ad that's basically going to try to take business dollars away from us. I mean, HBO buys ads that appear on NBC sometimes, sure. But to accept ads that basically tell you how to eliminate commercials when the networks need those commercials to promote the shows, well, that's not going to fly. And so Dish might be getting a taste of their own medicine.
Fox is going to auto-hop right over that one.
Exactly.
Joe Flint of the LA Times, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Los Angeles may not have a professional football team right now, but the city's other teams are really filling the void here. The Lakers and the Clippers are in the NBA playoffs, and the Kings have advanced to the NHL playoffs. And here's the thing. They're all playing this weekend in the same arena, the Staples Center. Marketplace's Eve Tro reports.
When the Lakers made the playoffs at the Staples Center...
Ladies and gentlemen, Game 7 goes to the Los Angeles Lakers.
No one was thinking, this is a hockey rink.
That, in fact, underneath the hardwood, they still have the ice down for the Kings.
Chris Lamberth designed sports venues at 360 Architecture. He says at Staples, the basketball court and the best rows of seats sit on top of the ice on a temporary floor. So two sports can play the same day. Even when the two basketball teams play back-to-back, it's a squeeze to swap the signs and clean the arena in between. But two sold-out crowds a day? Stadium owners salivate at the prospect. The trend has been one team, one venue. Then in the off-season, cities use the arena for conventions or monster truck rallies. But pro sports bring in way more money than those one-off events, says sports economist Dan Rasher.
That's been part of the push of the local governments to say, hey, why do we want to build two different facilities? Let's build one.
Sports arenas are getting more expensive, all those luxury boxes. Two games a day can help pay for a new stadium twice as fast. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
And finally, the online site Deadspin has an account of a woman in Philadelphia who was asked to fill out a customer service questionnaire after briefly dating this guy. The guy submitted questions via email like, please rate Mike's outfit 1 to 10. Or, really, Mike is very self-conscious about his hair. Does he have reason to be?
Wow.
Yes, Mike said he was into, quote, data collection. And yes, he works in finance.
And yes, he's probably still going to be looking for a little while on this website. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update on APM, American Public Media.